Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha and hello to you too, Chris Vandercook.
Hi, Beth Ann. Happy International Women's Day.
Yes, it is that, and we'll be talking about that a little later on in the program, but thank you.
We will. And meanwhile, we've been going about education in kind of the same way for quite a while, haven't we?
For decades and decades and decades.
Yeah.
And the question is really, where has it gotten us? Now, over generations, America's schools have faced the daunting task of using education to overcome huge differences in social and economic status that handicap poor kids and benefit others. They have not been very successful. A key reason why is that schools begin their work when it's too late, and even the pre-K programs last too few hours in a workday, disadvantaging many working parents. Contributing editor Neil Milner considered a different approach to learning readiness, spotlighted in a recent essay by Catherine Stevens, a research fellow in education policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Neil Milner is back with a long view look at early childhood education. Good morning.
Morning.
As you look at what we have seen traditionally over the last, you know, decades and decades and decades, most of our lives, most of our listeners' lives, the idea of getting kids ready to enter, you know, first grade, getting them ready to enter kindergarten, even some programs like Head Start to do all of that have all been very well intentioned. But a lot of the criticism has been that it's starting too late because of what we now know about kids' brain development starting at birth. How does that sync with some of what you've read?
Well, the important thing is to understand how early the divergence between families under stress, children and families under stress, whether they're poor or single-parent families, and other kinds of families begin. And it begins with brain development, and it begins not that long after birth. And so what you have is a diverging path between kids coming from stressed families and kids coming from other families that continues to diverge. And it's all part of this inequality process that we've seen develop over the years. That's not just income inequality. So what you've always relied on when you've relied on this at all is the schools to overcome some of this. When I was a kid, they didn't even worry about this stuff. But when we began to be more concerned about poverty, schools have a hard time overcoming socioeconomic differences. And one of the reasons is, one of it is that you just can't do it through the school thing. So Catherine Stevens says what you should do is not even focus on pre-K. That's too late. And remember, many states have pre-K, and I think the pre-K programs tend to work all right. You have to go to what I call pre-pre-K, that given the fact that parents work, given the fact that the parent is still with is still the primary developer of a kid's brain through communication and so on, you need education during those daylight hours when the parents aren't around at a very early stage that teaches the kinds of skills that can overcome some of these deficits.
Isn't that asking a lot of daycare?
Well, it is asking a lot of daycare. It's actually making daycare operate in somewhat different ways on the basis of other programs. What you need in this kind of situation are daycare facilities for kids, in other words, two years old, 1 year old, that begin a process of education and brain development through games and so on. I make it sound more sterile than it really is. And so if you're going to do that, essentially you're saying we're not going to worry about pre-K so much. We're going to have these programs that exist at an earlier level.
So how do you move into something like that, which sounds, you know, tremendous as an effort to be able to get caregivers who would be able to be trained in all of that, and then to get parents to understand what the difference might be between, you know, daycare A and daycare B, and then get the federal government to buy into it?
Well, first of all, let's start with your last thing. She's not that concerned. She says the federal government can do certain things, but you certainly can't run these programs in a centralized manner. So this is what she says, and you'll hear some key buzzwords here. She said, look, there is no single way to do this. The best way to do it is to decentralize the process and have a competitive process whereby people come forward with proposals on how to do this. parents have a choice to choose programs, and what government can do is to facilitate these things by licensing the teachers, by having the certain kind of standards, and by parents helping to get information. But she relies on a process of, let's say, states like Minnesota has this kind of thing, and parents of where are developing their own programs. She said, look, there are educational processes out there that have been tested. She talks about the Abbasetter project in North Carolina that does this kind of early learning. But you see what you're introducing here. You're introducing a decentralized process. You're saying you can't run this at the federal level. There isn't a single way to do this, and that you rely on the process of competition. That is, if somebody wants money for this, you have to compete for it. If it's government money, if some money somewhere else, and it's not a building that's a public school. So you can begin to hear what the political difficulties are with this.
Well, and I was going to ask you, because certainly we now have a new Secretary of Education who's very much in favor of parental choice.
Well, and that's one of the problems here, because I think what happens, and Stevens talks about this from one perspective, but there is this other. This is what happens when you introduce this into education, which is in many ways so politicized, that she said one of the first obstacles you have, and let's start with this one, which is not the one you just raised. The first obstacle you have is you have all kinds of stakeholders who wouldn't want to do this. You do have pre-K programs. You do have people involved at the earlier level, that at the later level, that might object to this kind of thing. But what you also have, and this is what you're likely to get from our new Secretary of Education, is true believers who simply look at the idea that this is decentralized, that it's based, that it's kind of market-based, that it's competitive, and just assume that the process of choice is enough. Now, we've done shows, we've done sessions on the fact that the people who run schools that are based on choice and charter schools know, the second generation, that what makes them successful is not the process of choice. It's these little micro things that go on and how you actually do the educational process. And that's what I worry about would get lost in the kind of political fight over whether this is good or not.
You're really coming down to the fact that it comes down to the program itself and really knowing how those results are being made public or attracting another audience. So as we have to just go in about 30 seconds, what do you take away from all of this to at least consider from the standpoint of people who would like to be able to get better care for their kids? Because you mentioned that some of these states, including Minnesota, have had some of their own programs.
I think it's a model worth looking at least to some extent. And in some ways, Hawaii is stumbling into this kind of model because they don't have a universal pre-K. I think it's worth looking at a little closer. I think that once you take the ideology out of it, it has some valuable possibilities, but it's very daunting. And again, education is as much about particular schools doing things particular ways, and it'll be the same thing with these early education programs.
Gives new meaning to granular education.
Yes.
Thanks,
and you're
Neil.
Not sugarcoating that either.
No. Neil Milner is a retired professor of political science. He is our contributing editor and joins us twice a month for The Long View.